Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
You got a drink?
I have.
What are you drinking? Same as last week?
No, last week was a Lagavulin 16. This week 16. It's a Lagavulin 8. The Lagavulin 16 was the last of the bottle that was a Father's Day present.
Oh, yes.
This is the first of the bottle that was my 10-year Rosiversary present from Megan and Riley and Sadie. I got one other present, which was a bottle of Bundy from my cousin Julian.
Welcome to Australia. Here's a bottle of Bundy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to actually keg the beers that I was making the other week. I know last episode I promised I'd be drinking it this week, but you know what I ended up doing on the weekend instead?
What did you end up doing on the weekend?
I ended up making 15 graves out in the front yard.
Graves?
Graves, yeah. For Halloween.
That's grim. What?
For Halloween.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay, very good. That's a bit better.
Yeah, it's quite effective, but it's quite a sustainable way to do it. I just get some topsoil delivered.
Yeah.
I line up the graves out the front.
Yeah.
Halloween finishes, I get the rake and I just top dress the front yard.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So it works well. Convenient. But the rest of the weekend was carting the rest of the topsoil down to the backyard.
Yeah.
And top dressing that grass too. So it was quite a labor intensive weekend. I really, really could have handled having a beer out of the keg.
Yeah.
But it just was not there. Hopefully next weekend I'll be able to get that in the keg.
Yeah. Oh, nice. That'd be good.
Yeah. And before last weekend, we were running a competition about giving away tickets to AdaConf.
That's right, we were.
Vaguely recall.
I vaguely remember.
Yeah, that's not far away now. By the time this episode gets released, it's just before AdaConf. I'm so excited for that. So we've reached out to the lucky winner, but did you want to announce it just now?
No, I think let's wait until we can get hold of him. It's, you know, it's probably better if he knows before other people. And not the other way around.
Hopefully he's going to get back to us before the day before AdaConf.
Well, you know, if he doesn't, we might have to go to a backup.
Fair enough. Fine. Keep everyone in suspense for just that little bit longer.
Well, at least you know, all right?
Yeah. That's right.
So I was telling you, speaking of the weekend, so I did have plans to have a barbecue to celebrate my 10 years of Australian citizenship. Which I did. I did have that barbecue. Yep. It ended up being much more subdued than originally planned, which was quite nice in its own way. So my cousin Julian, he came, and this is the one that I went away for his wedding in Poland back in June and July. So he came along and we spoke quite a bit about vibe coding, which, you know, he's not a developer, but he's been doing a bit. And he's building an app. So that was an interesting discussion. And the thing that's really interesting in it about it as well is that he's very well aware of his limitations and the limitations of what he can do with it. And it's just so, it's really interesting because it's really aligned with what we were talking about last time. He's pretty much come to exactly the same conclusions that we have.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. The other thing that I thought was interesting was that, of course, I got this beautiful bottle of whiskey from my family to celebrate the occasion. And as I mentioned, I got a bottle of rum from my cousin to celebrate. And of course, I got a absolutely beautiful handmade card from Riley, which
amazing.
Did I show you that?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. Let me, I took a picture of it because it's just so beautiful. Let me grab a picture of that card and I'll just send it to you and you can see this wonderful card Riley made for me to commemorate the occasion.
Oh, look at that. So cute. What can I see? Is there a cat?
Oh, there's a cat there.
Can I see a cat?
She's cat obsessed, yeah.
Yeah. What else? Looks like there's an emu.
Yep.
At the top right, I can see an emu. Is that a crocodile underneath the cat? Is a crocodile eating a cat?
Yep.
Okay. It's pretty cool. Surely she didn't write that.
She did. Oh, she wrote that. Under her own volition? No. Like, look, she can't. She doesn't know how to write. You know, no. She knows how to write letters, but not words.
Did you want to share what you had your four-year-old daughter write in a card?
Or, hey, or look.
You didn't have her because obviously.
Like, first of all, it was as much a surprise to me as it was to you. And she's five, for the record.
Five, sorry. All that much. They're much more mature.
That's right. Absolutely. Clearly much more ready for that kind of language. So I shared with Liam a picture of this card and he looked at the outside of the card, which is some very cute drawings. There's little Australia at the bottom.
That's what it is. It is too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an emu. There's a cat. There's a crocodile, like you said. Few things. There's a love heart, believe it or not. And then, of course, Liam got to the inside where there's this absolutely delightful handwritten message that says, "Happy 10 years of being a sick cunt."
And I can see a platypus on there too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Of course, yeah, there's a platypus. Yep.
There's a platypus. And is it an echidna in the middle?
I don't know about an echidna. Is that
between the platypus and the crocodile is like a rock with spikes coming out of it.
Oh, yes. Maybe that is an echidna.
Or is that a koala, not a cat, above the
crocodile? Oh, sorry. No, that's a koala, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. See? So actually, sorry. That's a koala. And the thing between the crocodile and the platypus is a cat.
Okay. So I can read kids' drawings. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty talented.
And of course, the penmanship is just phenomenal.
Oh, that's like my handwriting, though.
Yeah. It's like your language as well.
My language doesn't get that colorful. So, sounds like you had a really busy weekend.
I did.
You've just been flat out with no time for any side projects over the last couple of weeks.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I was flat out working on a side project. Actually, I haven't shown you this. Let me send you a link. So this is very, very much a work in progress, this website, but this is the landing page for an app that I'm working on. And again, this is kind of a I'm building it because we need it thing, but it will be out there and people can use it. The screenshots are completely made up. They're not from the actual app, but the rest of it is pretty accurate. I was saying to Liam that I've got some code that I've been working on, a project that I've been working on, and I wanted to talk about that. But I also said that, I asked him if he thought it would be interesting for us to talk about. And he said, not really, but we haven't got anything better to talk about, so we may as well.
Not quite what I said, but
it's not at all what you said, but it's what you thought.
No, absolutely not.
But what I said in part of that was that it was born out of necessity and it was born because of something else I'm working on and I had a need. And the link that I've just shared to Liam is an app for recording evidence and milestones for homeschooling. So we are currently thinking about the homeschooling option and we've been looking at, you know, obviously part of what you've got to do is you can't just say, oh yeah, we're homeschooling our kids and then you're just left to it. Like you still have to report to the Department of Education and you've got to have evidence and so on and so forth. And there are a couple of well-known apps for this, neither of which are actually apps for this, right? So there's one that's a white label app and it's meant for use by institutions that support homeschooling. And what they do is they basically white label it and package it as their app for their institution and they get families to use that. Yep. The other one is completely different. It's meant for teachers and it's meant for teachers for assigning work for pupils and students that are at home. And it's a way of that work being assigned and then the work being completed and tracked. So it's really meant for parents to track the work that their teachers. But the homeschooling communities have all kind of said it works really well if you do this, 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 and this. And Megan downloaded it and she just couldn't work out how to do it. And she's not stupid, right? She's tech savvy. She's a lawyer. She knows her way around an app. She's the mastermind behind other software things that I've produced. And she couldn't figure it out. And she gave it to me and I couldn't. No, I did figure it out, but I didn't figure it out through using it. I figured it out through pages and pages of reading the manual, which most of which was completely irrelevant. So she said, look, what I want is this. I want something that's very quick and easy. I just want to be able to record an activity, select the subject, put some notes, add some attachments, say which child it's relevant to and save it. And that's it. And I need to be able to report on it and generate and export data. So she said, can you build that? And I said, yes, of course. So I've built that. Now, it all works. And obviously, the technology that I'm using for this is .NET MAUI, because that's what I do.
Because there's a good book about it.
Yeah, that can recommend a book about it.
Yep.
And what I actually did, though, was I built it in Blazor Hybrid, which we've spoken about before, but just to recap, do you remember what that is?
Blazor Hybrid, is that server rendered, is it?
Not quite. So Blazor, when you run it in the browser, has got two flavors. Well, it did have, now it's overly complicated. But you had WASM, which is the WebAssembly, and that's where .NET runs on the WebAssembly virtual machine in the browser. And then you've got Blazor Server, where the DOM, the state of the DOM is managed in memory on the server, and a WebSocket is used to send updates to and from the browser in real time.
Yep.
Right. MAUI Blazor Hybrid is another thing. The way that works is kind of similar conceptually to Blazor Server, except the server runs on your phone. What it means is you can write a .NET MAUI app, a cross-platform mobile and desktop app. It runs as a MAUI app, so it runs using fully managed .NET on your device, on the, you know, as a compiled installed app. And everything is all the same as any other .NET MAUI app, except the UI layer itself. So instead of writing the UI in XAML, you render the UI in Blazor.
Okay.
So I decided to build this app using that technology for a few reasons. But one of them is that I'm going to publish this app on the store and it'll be free and anyone can use it and that's fine. But it will just be a standalone app on the device. I'm going to build a back end so that we can log in via a browser and we can have logins and we can, you know, use it on the web. And that means that whatever Megan saves on her phone, I can see as well and vice versa.
Sure.
And, you know, using the web will be a bit nicer for exports and so on and so forth. That back end part, I'm not going to give away for free. Well, actually, again, I might. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I'm not going to host that for free. It's not going to be something that I'm going to put online and people will be able to use as an online service for free. Yeah. Because it comes with all kinds of security implications, yeah, especially when you think about the fact that you've got data related to children in there,
yep,
including photos, which may or may not be of the children. And I'm not saying that's something I'm against hosting and a service that I'm running, but I would obviously want a lot of security and control around that. And yep, that comes at a price. And I just need to figure out whether this is viable as a product, like whether I can do it for a price that people will actually pay for it or not. I don't know yet. I'm still figuring that out. But
I got a great resource you can use on that. There's right, this podcast. They've got this episode called Can You Afford a Tech Startup?
Yeah.
It sounds exactly like the one you need. Do you want me to send you a link?
If you could, that'd be great. Yeah. And I mean, the problem here is not the dev costs, it's the running costs, right? So I know exactly how much this is going to cost me to build and run. What I don't know is whether people will pay what it will take, right? That's the difference. If that's the case, what I will probably do is sell the back end as maybe as a container image that people can just buy, or maybe I'll give it away. I haven't decided yet. I don't know. But if I'm not going to run it as a service that people can sign up for as a subscription, if that's not viable, I'll make it available another way. But point is, that's not something I'm going to be able to run for free. That's just going to cost too much.
Yep.
Right. So yeah, I mean, I'm going to deploy it to my own environment as a container using, you know, and I'll protect it potentially behind a VPN. And if not through some other kind of tunnel, I don't know. If I put it online, it's going to have all kinds of controls. It's going to have a WAF. It's going to have some kind of intrusion detection and an API gateway, some monitoring, like all kinds of things, because there's, you know, that's not something I'm going to host without that level of control. Cool. Anyway, that gives you an idea that sets the scenes for the problem that I faced. Now, here's the problem that I faced. So back in the day, if you wanted to build a mobile app with .NET, you would choose Xamarin or Xamarin Forms. And if you needed data locally on the device, the decision was kind of made for you about how you would do that, because there was one very well-established player in the space and it was very good. And there's really no reason not to use it. And that was
SQLite?
Yeah, SQLite.net. Yep. So SQLite.net was made and curated by Frank Kruger. I may have mentioned him before.
Yep.
He worked with one of the guys on the actual SQLite team as well, a guy called Eric Sink. And yeah, you know, and like it was what most people used for years, right? Then when Maui came along, things got a bit trickier and there was some hoops that you had to jump through and you had to have different packages targeting your different... Actually, I mean, you always had to do this. So I don't know if you remember in Xamarin Forms, you would have three projects, right? You'd have what was called the head project, which would be your Xamarin Forms app. And then you'd have a platform specific project.
Yep.
In .NET 6 and onwards, because you have multi-targeting, you don't need that. You just have the one app, right?
Yeah, okay.
So you have the one app and it can target .NET X, .NET X for iOS, .NET X for Android. So you would have to import those packages and you would have to use MS build conditions to target them to the different platform, depending on what you wanted to do. Okay, so we got over that hurdle, right? And that's fine. You can do that. I decided to try something called LightDB because I've been looking at it for a long time and I was using it. I used it before. Did you ever see the app that I released called Tracky Talk?
You told me about it, but I don't know if I saw it.
It's basically a speak and spell as an app, for want of a better word. It's a text-to-speech app, and it's meant for patients who are physiologically nonverbal as opposed to neurologically nonverbal. So there are apps available for nonverbal patients, but they're all geared towards neurologically nonverbal patients. So they're all geared towards people that can't form words. So they tend to be, they tend to use iconography, things that evoke feelings or images and what have you.
Yep.
My app is for, it's called Tracky Talk because it was inspired by when my mom was in ICU and she had a tracheostomy and she physically was unable to speak.
Yeah.
Of course, she had a phone and she could use speech to text on it, but also, you know, she was on a lot of painkillers and she wasn't really out of it. She didn't have the dexterity for using the tiny little on-screen keyboard.
Yep.
She didn't have, you know, really the focus to look at text that small. So that's why I say it's basically a speak and spell. It's a full screen keyboard, like a Fisher-Price keyboard. You type things out and then it can speak them. And the text is big. Very, very simple. Anyway, I wanted a rudimentary way of doing predictive text. Like I didn't want a full predictive text dictionary, but I wanted it to save words and phrases that you used. So as you start to type, it can offer them and then you can just tap it and make it say that.
Yeah.
And that means I needed persistence on the device. So I chose to use LightDB because of how fast it claimed to be. And I released it. And ever since I released it, it's worked fine on Android. Apart from one star review I had from one guy who said, and I quote, "No good app, use this instead." And I replied to the review and said, "Thanks for the feedback. I'm really keen to understand what you don't like about it, what you prefer about this other app," so on and so forth. The other app was completely different. It was a handwriting to speech app for Android. And I guess he saw it as competition. He was clearly the author of that app. Google have removed that review. But other than that, it's received relatively positive feedback. But the iOS version, I can't get to work. It keeps crashing. And I never knew why until now. Now I know, right?
Yeah.
So let me give you the current state. So I've building this app. The app is called Boothby for people that, because I shared the link with Liam and no one else can see that. So the app is called Boothby. It's this homeschooling app. So I needed persistence on the device because you need to be able to save the data to the device. And I need it to be encrypted, obviously, because it's very important. It's these potentially photos of children, potentially other information about children. I wanted it secure. But I also, it needs to be searchable, at least have rudimentary search. So I wanted it to be indexed.
Yep.
So I initially went with LightDB because it ticked all those boxes. It supports encryption out of the box. It's not on by default, but it supports it. There's some things that have always bothered me about it. So one of them is that there's no async API. The guy says you don't need it. It's so fast. It really doesn't matter. It's like, yeah, but I'm really not comfortable running blocking calls on the UI thread on a mobile app. So that means I've got everything punted off to other threads using task.run. And that was not the cause of my problems, but that certainly helped obscure my problems for a while. So again, thinking back to Brandon's famous talk on Async Await, I fell into every single one of those traps trying to resolve this problem. Where I got to with it, though, was the other way around. It was working beautifully, absolutely beautifully on iOS, would not run on Android.
And so the opposite of the track you talk about.
Yes, and the opposite because of changes in .NET and changes in the way that I have deployed it, which I'll come to in a minute. No, I'll tell you now, right? So, okay. So I, short version of this is that with .NET 10, which comes out in a week and a half now, it's AOT first. So native AOT first. So again, I don't know if you remember when we were talking to Brandon, which must be a year and a half ago now, maybe more. It was NDC last year.
NDC,
which was February last
so
year.
Year and a half,
Year and a half. So I don't know if you remember, like, so that would have been, I guess, when .NET 8 had more or less just come out. And, you know, AOT was the big thing. And we were talking to him about that. And he was sort of saying, you know, us Xamarin folks are laughing at that, saying we've had AOT for years, right? So the AOT that kind of shipped with .NET 8 and what we were talking about with Brandon, what the big excitement about was then was about the chipset, was about, well, specifically the instruction set, right? So you could compile an assembly that's targeted for a specific chipset. And that means that it's AOT compiled. And that means that it strips out a whole bunch of instructions that aren't relevant, right? That's how the tree shaking works. We speculated. So with .NET, it is historically and traditionally a JIT language, a JIT framework. So that's just-in-time compilation. What that means is that your code gets compiled to IL, intermediate language, and then at runtime, it gets just-in-time compiled as and when needed. And this, that's a whole other conversation. Let's not go into that. Anyway, with .NET 10, it's AOT first. So everything is AOT by default. And with .NET 9, with MAUI, you can basically turn that on. And that's kind of how things work. But that's native AOT. So what that means is that you get a version of your app that's compiled for iOS without any JIT, without any kind of runtime compilation.
Yeah.
So why was this a problem for LightDB? This is a problem for LightDB because it uses expression funks for its link extension. It uses link extensions. I can see your face.
I can see where that's going. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So that means that the link expressions are not AOT compatible, basically not AOT compatible.
No, they're dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was able to get around that on iOS and I just could not get it to work on Android. I just could not get it to work. And I tried everything. I tried basically disabling linking, disabling AOT, adding the runtime interpreter. But it just didn't work. And I was jumping through hoops and I just couldn't get it to work. So I thought about switching to Old Faithful, which was SQLite.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. And I started to try it and I just gave up. I stopped in my tracks. And I'll tell you why. I have already had problems with SQLite on Android. And the reason is that simultaneously to all this stuff that we're talking about, and Google have introduced a new 16 KB page size requirement for all new builds shipped to the Google Play Store by November 1. So if your builds do not honor that 16 KB page size, they'll get rejected. So yeah. They're not going to pull your app from the store yet. I mean, obviously they do eventually anyway. Like I think anything that doesn't get an update in 2 years is pulled, and that's the same across both stores, but they're not pulling anything for this just yet. But yeah, you can't submit an app that doesn't honor that. Now Maui does, like everything in Maui does, there's no issue there, but all of your dependencies have to as well. So this means I was now in the position where I needed something that would support encryption, support the 16 KB page size, and be AOT friendly.
Yep.
And SQLite.net was nearly there. So one of the problems facing SQLite is that Frank Kruger has kind of gone missing. Don't know exactly. Like, look, obviously he's a busy guy. Hopefully he's okay, but he's not been responsive on that repo. Eric has, and Eric has got some packages that he's shipped, so you can run it. Now, Eric also used to have an open source community package called SQL Cipher. So SQLite does not natively internally first party support encryption, but it does support it by extensibility. The extensibility is quite tricky. And I looked into that and I thought, do I just provide my own encryption? And I'll come into why in a minute. But Eric has stopped publishing his version of that for all kinds of different reasons. It's very hard to keep up. In fact, you know how many times I've said that mobile dev is hard and cross-platform mobile dev is harder and it's different to like API and cloud and all that stuff? Yeah, this is why, right? There's like all these things that you just don't know about. Like the thing I was talking to my cousin about, like he's built like through vibe coding, this awesome UI, this whole backend architecture, which won't scale, but that is far from the point. And he doesn't care, and nor should he at this stage. But he can't get it onto a device. And he can't get it onto a device for various reasons. And one of those reasons is that he needs some specific platform functionality. I'm going way off topic here, and I don't want to go into that. But yeah, mobile dev is hot. So Eric stopped publishing this, and I thought, well, do I do my own? And I looked into that, and that's hard. The alternative is SQL Cipher, the commercial one, and that's $1,000 a year. Now, if you remember at the start of this, I said that I didn't know if anyone was going to be able to pay for this, let alone how much they would. There's no way that I can pay $1,000 a year, that's US, for a license for this encryption for this database. And by the way, that's not a community license, as in you pay if you earn over blah, blah, blah. The rules of the community license are your project has to be open source. Yeah. That's the rule, right? So if it's closed source, you don't qualify, you have to use the commercial license.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could open source it, but it's, you know, I still potentially want to commercialize it, and so I wouldn't qualify. So I was sitting there scratching my head, and I was looking to SQL, and I was like, I was jumping through so many hoops, and I didn't, you know, I worked really hard on this. I spent probably 2 days on trying to get it to work with LightDB, and then maybe another half a day toying with different ways of SQLite. And then I thought back to our episode before last, and I thought, do I actually need a database? And I don't, right? And the short version of this is I built a data store, and it's a very, very simple data store, and it's very lightweight. It's got very basic indexing. So when you save something, text, it tokenizes it. And it tokenizes it in a very, very simple way. It does it by, it takes your block of text and it splits it into words or tokens. And it does that using either spaces or punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
And just tokenizes it, right? And it looks in the index and it finds every token. And it creates an entry in the index or adds it to the entry if there is one for that token. When you delete something, it removes it from that token. If it's the last thing, it removes the token. So, you know, if there's no more entries for Liam, it deletes Liam from the index.
Yep.
And it's extensible. Like it's got we can talk about the technology. I provided one implementation, which is basically just flat files. So you can store, it will basically, index will tell you where it is the short version. It will tell you what file it's in. So it's very, very simple token-based searching, but it meets my needs. And I've built on top of it since then. I've built some abstraction layers around it. Again, it's not a database. I've built some link extensions. I had to do a few things to make that AOT friendly. My predicates are funk ball and not funk expression. That's the first thing. And I also have to use the JSON serializer source generator to generate, otherwise system.txt.json needs to use reflection. But yep. There's an attribute you can add, which is JSON serializable, and that basically pre-generates all of the source that's needed for that. So that's how I was able to get around that. Encryption, like obviously .NET has all kinds of cryptography. I'm using a actually one of the things when you upload to the stores is you've got to jump through hoops around encryption as well. So if you're using non-standard encryption, because obviously the NSA have to have a backdoor to your app, that's mandatory.
Yep.
So I decided to go with something standard. I'm just using AES 256. Like, that's probably good enough for this. I can easily change it. But that's also extensible as well. You can be BYO encryption cryptography provider. And yeah, so I've basically now got a flat file store, which is encrypted and indexed. I've done a whole bunch of benchmarking around it, really out of curiosity. And I was actually blown away by how fast it is. And at first, when I started doing the benchmarking, I based it on one file per record. And it's kind of fast enough if you do that. Like, it's not blazingly fast. I mean, it's fast, right? It's in milliseconds, right? But it's, you know, it's not as fast as something like SQLite or LightDB. And then I thought, well, why am I doing that? Like, that's really not how you should be using it. And that's certainly not how I'll be using it. So then I started to think of the files themselves as an aggregated data store. I don't want to say table because they're not a table. In fact, if you look in the docs, I've got like the Dr. Evil meme going table. it's a useful heuristic, but they're not tables, right? And then I started doing it that way and I was getting blazingly fast results. Like it's like as fast as SQLite or LightDB. And I was thinking, well, like, you know, for my tests, I'm basically mounting an entire table or data store in memory, but it's still blazingly fast. I ran up to like 10,000 records in these things and they're still like not cracking 100 meg, which sure, maybe that's inefficient, but like this is a mobile device in 2025. Yeah. And I've got like God knows how many gigs of RAM on the thing. And oh, by the way, these benchmarks are unlike containers in Linux. Like when I run them on Mac OS, they blow it out of the water. Like everything's sub millisecond. I mean, there's a demo app in the repo.
Yeah.
And like I have run some of the demos on the simulator on iOS. I haven't run them on on Android. Haven't run them on an iOS physical device yet. But again, like the benchmarking I get is like in the worst case scenario, when you use it as unoptimally as possible, it's still good enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I've been working on that for a few days. It's still a work in progress. There's still lots to do. I have open sourced it. It's on GitHub. It's called Cabinet. We can put the link in the chat. It's on NuGet. If anyone wants to play with it and use it, you can. I've got lots more to do in it. I've got big plans for it, but these are for myself. And like, basically I've just started swapping that into my app and yeah, like just does everything that I need without any cost. And you know, the best part about this is that the reason that you get these problems with the other things like SQLite and LightDB is because they run on platform native code. So they have platform native dependencies. Yeah. That of course has an impact on all kinds of things like particularly reflection and runtime interpreting, the page size, like all of this is like, if you look at the repo, languages C# 100%. Like all of this is pure .NET code, runs anywhere. Yeah. Like it is intended for MAUI apps. In fact, I originally called it plugin.maui.offlinedata and I renamed it not because it's not primarily for MAUI use. It is, but because it's not a MAUI plugin. Like it started off as a MAUI class library. Yep. And I pulled that all out because the tests were having issues with the multi-targeting. And I thought, why am I multi-targeting? I'm not using any like MAUI code here at all. So yeah, it's 100% pure .NET class library. It's currently on .NET 9. I will upgrade it to .NET 10 like within the next few days.
Mm-hmm.
Like 100% AOT compatible. It's got extensive docs that tell you how to use it optimally. It's got all these quality of life. So everything I've described is quite low level, but it's got some higher level abstractions around it. So I created an abstraction called record set. And again, I don't want to say it's like a DB set because it isn't. This isn't a database, right? It's not a database. Yeah. I can't reinforce that enough and I'll explain why, but it's not a database, right? But the DB, the record set extension is kind of there to be a quality of life, just make things easier, like better developer experience. So because it's not a database, right? And because of what I said about indexing, like let's say I've got my record set of my lessons and I want to search for a lesson and I want to filter by subject and by student and by some other keywords, yeah, right? To do that, I have to do my indexing first, find the relevant records, deserialize those into an iQueryable basically, and just the records that have come out of the index. And then when I've got my iQueryable, I can start doing my predicates on that. So I can do link queries or whatever on that,
yeah,
right? And then there's some other things as well. But what I basically do is I put all that deferred execution into extension methods in an extension class, which does it all transparently. And it kind of, the reason I say it's kind of like a DB set is because that works the same way with the deferred execution. You can build up your query and your task, and it doesn't execute it until you do to list async, at which point it does those steps first where it loads it if it's not already in the cache. And everything caches in memory, as I said. And again, like it's not meant for large data sets. And when I say large data sets, like I was benchmarking 10,000 records and it wasn't batting an eye at it. So yeah, real world use. Like I was thinking real world use. If I added 3 records a day, every day, it would take me, 3 years to get to 10,000 records. I have to check my math. But it's like, so, you know, like large record sets, it's not meant for that. But even if you are abusing it, like it's still going to be fine. So so that's why it's caching memory. But yeah, the point is it just abstracts all that. It does it all in extension methods for you. If you want to do the lower level bit, you can. If you want to, like, everything there is, it's got all the knobs and dials. You can control everything. If you want to use it for something else, you can. But for the core use case, which is, as I said, secure, indexed, encrypted, offline, local data, like it does the job, and it does it as good as, if not better than the alternatives without any of the baggage.
Yep. Because back to our discussion the other day on databases, because you're using the right technologies or the right structure for your use case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like if you use the record set extensions, it is opinionated. Well, look, it has defaults. It has very opinionated defaults about how it structures and stores your data. And that was a design decision, because I thought the target audience of users of those record set extensions is basically Cabinet for Dummies users. So me, basically, right? I thought, how do I want to use this? I want to use it where it quote unquote just works. I don't want to have to configure all this stuff. Like it's working now with all this config, but I don't want that. I want that to go away. And I thought about, what am I compromising for that? What am I losing? And I thought, all the things that I'm compromising are things that I actively want to compromise anyway. But then all those knobs and dials, as I said, are there for anyone that wants to do it differently. Mm. As I said, you can do that low level stuff. But the point is, if you're not using that record set approach and you do go lower level, it's not opinionated at all about how you structure or store your data, because it's literally just flat files.
Yeah.
So you basically, it serializes whatever you throw at it, however you serialize it. And it just indexes it on the way in and removes it from the index on the way out, encrypts it transparently. Everything's atomic. All operations are atomic. So it's not mounting anything to disk. Obviously, the risk there is that if your app crashes, it stays mounted. You know, so like everything's in memory, atomic write. And I wasn't actively thinking, we did this episode a couple of weeks ago on, you know, having your domain models be your primary model and they should drive your persistence. I better stick to this. I just built it the way that I wanted to use it. And as I was doing it, I kind of realized that, yes, this basically lets you do that. And you know what you were saying on that episode as well? Well, you raised it. It's true of me as well. Is you we're so conditioned to think in terms of the relational model.
Mm.
I have been finding it hard. I'm actively fighting that, right?
Yeah.
Because that is my default and that is how I think. And I have to keep thinking, no, I'm not doing it that way, because that's not how it should work and that's not how I want it to work.
I mean, you said that like when you were running the benchmarks.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Your original benchmarks were looking at it in a relational way until you adjusted your...
Oh, no, they weren't looking at it in a relational way, no. But they were looking at it in... What I was doing was if you think of every piece of data that it's saving as a record, it was saving each of those in an individual file.
Yeah.
So when I created in my benchmark 10,000 records, that was 10,000 individual encrypted files.
Yep.
But then when I started thinking, that's not how I'm actually intending to use it, nor am I how am I recommending anyone else uses it. And I started aggregating them into, you know, collections of files. Again, don't want to say tables.
Yeah.
Although like one file per type is the logical way. But anyway, when I started doing that, I got a 300% increase in performance. Like it's massive. It's night and day. And that kind of proves that the encryption and de-encryption, which is obviously in memory and fast, especially using the native platforms which support it all via TPM equivalent type chips, it's fast. It's the IO bound operations that are the bottleneck.
Yeah. So keep going then. Keep going.
The last thing I was going to say was that I keep saying it's not a database and it's not a database, and it isn't, right? And the reason I keep saying that is because, first of all, it's not a database. Like I didn't need need a database. And I don't think many people in this scenario do need a database. They just need a persistent store they can rely on.
Yep.
And this is probably enough for most people building Maui apps, I think. But the reason this is not a database is it doesn't do a lot of things that a database does. It has no sense of relationships, hierarchical, relational, however you want to call it. There is no relationship.
Yeah.
If you want those relationships, that's in your data, how you structure your data, which aligns with what we were saying about domain first.
Yeah.
So it kind of not only respects that, but it actually forces you to do it. It forces you to have domain first modeling, which is interesting. I mean, it doesn't actually. You don't have to. You can use it however you want, right? But there's no relationships. So there's no queries. There's no cross-entity queries, right? Mm. So you would have to think about it in the same way that you would think about your data sources in a distributed system or in a modular monolith, right?
Yep.
In fact, you can even think about your different files as bounding contexts yep. within different modules if you yeah, yeah. want to think about it that way. That's not necessarily the mental model I'm going with, but it operates the same way. So if I want to get all my invoices and then I want to get information about the buyers on those invoices, I would have to look up the buyers from a separate context using the IDs and rehydrate that data. Now, all of this happens in milliseconds, so that's fine. But it's not a database because you can't do, you know, cross-entity reads or anything like that.
Yeah.
It has no transactions, right?
No,
it's got no kind of unit
integrity.
And work. Sorry?
No referential integrity. Or
no referential integrity.
Yeah.
That's up to you to do in your domain, right?
Yep.
No, it's quote-unquote thread safe. And it's thread safe because it basically uses a semaphore. So it locks all IO operations to consecutive. So, and that's why I did think about maybe multi-threading it. And I thought, I don't need to. Like, it's way more than fast enough as it is. And Yagni didn't yep. want to. So, but that means it doesn't support multi-user, right? And fundamentally, a database needs to support multi-user. Like, arguably no, because there's personal databases. Sure, but you could think of this in that sense.
Yeah,
but yeah,
for 90% of the mobile devices, they are single user. I mean, yes, there's shared tablets and, you know, there are shared devices.
But that's why I argue that they don't need, most of these apps don't need a database. They need something like this.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's what I've been up to. So this is my side project, which is not really my side project. It's an enabling thing. And I started-
It's a side quest on your side project.
That's right. Yeah.
So talk to me about your dev experience.
Interesting. You should ask.
Because we've recently spoken quite a lot about vibe coding and whatnot.
Yeah.
And as this was a side quest,
yeah.
rather than the actual side project, I was just wondering, is this something that you wanted to tackle because you had an itch to scratch? Or is this something that you thought, you know what, I can get my junior AI agent to just knock this out of the park for me and I'll come back and see how it's going?
Well, it's a good question because, like, first of all, as I said, I didn't set out to do this, right? I wanted to use LightDB in this app.
Yeah.
And I wanted to use LightDB because I've liked the idea of LightDB for a long time. The reality is, unfortunately, not where I would like it to be. So LightDB is effectively maintained by one guy. He's got as is this. He's got a lot of great ideas.
As do you.
I don't have any great ideas. But I mean, I think, like, so for example, I'm not the only person asking about AOT and asking about async and async API, right?
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people asking about this, and he has said that he's going to be delivering them for years, and he hasn't. And I get that it's hard, but he has moved on to other features. Like, he's just announced like a vector store because yeah. that's the new hotness, and it's his product. He can do what he wants with it. But in my view, that kind of undermines its viability a little bit for this particular use case.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, 100% rules it out for me because, I spent longer than I wanted to on it and couldn't get it to work.
Yeah.
I didn't want to use SQLite because I didn't like messing with all those build conditions and the target framework yeah. conditions and having to have the different packages. Didn't like messing with the 16 KB page size thing is solved. But then there's the frustration of like, well, do I use Eric's package? What's happening with Frank's packages? So on and so forth. But whatever, like, that's by the by. But the cost of the encryption was a showstopper. Like, I just can't not have encryption
yeah.
on this app. and I can't pay $1,000 a year for it.
Yep.
So I looked at some other options and I started thinking about, what do I actually need? Could I store the data in a file? Yes. Can I encrypt the file? Yes. What about indexing? So I added that on. And really from there, it was just like one thing after another, just adding on and on until it grew into this. Now, to your other question, no, I didn't think I'm itching for something to assign to my AI junior. But if I wasn't using AI for this, and I used AI extensively for this, if I wasn't, I wouldn't have released this as an open source library or a NuGet package. I would have just built the core bit that I needed for my app and moved on.
Yep.
That's the major difference. And, you know, that generalization that I've done, like, I've done it for me. Like, I haven't done this for anyone else. Like, if other people find it useful, great. But, like, so for example, some of the arguments I got into with my junior, let me see if I can find some of the suggestions it came up with. Because there were some of the things it was saying, and I was just like, no. Like, it started to suggest roadmap. Oh, I had it. My VS Code is scrolling because it's run out.
It's run out of memory,
like you were saying last week. I'm trying to find the specific thing because I can't remember off the top of my head. But basically, it was starting saying, yeah, you know, database features essentially. And I said, no, I'm never going to do that. That's completely the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Oh, where is it? Oh, yeah. So basically, I was riffing off it and I said, look, I would like to add a source generator to automatically generate the partial class with the JSON serializable attribute. So it's a source generator of the source generator.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same way that I did it with the MAUI page resolver. I don't know if you know, that's got a source generator with attributes. It's like, it's really easy to do. So my view was, instead of having a partial class where I add all these serializers attributes, I just create my own attribute, decorate whatever classes I want to be serializable, and then for it to generate a partial class with those serializable attributes.
Yeah, okay.
That then reference the ones that I've decorated.
Yep.
So it started going on, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Do this, 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 and this. And I said, well, I need to ship this as it is because I need to put it into my own app. But could you please generate a roadmap file, just a markdown file, and just put those notes in there because I'll come back and do that. So it did it. And then it started putting in this other stuff. And it put in phase one, this thing, phase two, this, this, and this. And it was like
very ambitious.
I've lost it again. I've completely lost it. Where is it? It was basically things like transactions and relationships and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, here we go. Advanced features. Schema analysis from existing DBs. No, that's something else. Sorry, that's something else. That's about migrations. That's something else that I want to do, and I will come back to it in a minute. Yeah. So advanced features. It wanted to do things like transactions, cross entity queries, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And it started laying out a spec for that. And I just said, no, I don't want that. It's not a database. It never will be. And there's also, by the way, in the docs that I've put here, I've put some pretty clear guidance on when you should just use a database. And it's not just on number of records. It's like, if you need like transactions, you need a database. This isn't going to give you that.
Yep.
If you need like cross entity queries, you need a database. This isn't going to give you that. Like, all those things that we just said doesn't do it. Like, no, it doesn't. And it's not going to. That's not what it's for. Like, if you need a database, you need a database. That's fine. If you don't need a database, you probably don't need a database. You can just use something like this.
I guess that comes back to the discussion last week about the LLMs are only, like, they don't come up with novel ideas. So when you're telling it that you're working on a data store, it conflates that back to a database.
Yeah, that's
right. And the requirements for a good database server, and thinks, oh, well, that's what you want.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's
it. So that was, you know, and again, it hadn't built that, but it had created a spec for it. And I just said, no, take that out. But, you know, in other cases, do you remember what I was saying last time, that sometimes I get it, I ask it things and I get it to challenge me, and it does, right? And so one of the other things I said was, should we move all the extension methods into a separate assembly? So I've got cabinet, and I thought, well, in here I've got core, which is like the interfaces. I've got the offline data store, the persistent index implementation, that kind of stuff. But then I've got the extensions, which is the link extension. So there's like the record query, there's the record set. And I said, should those be in a separate assembly? And it gave me a very, very, very well-reasoned answer where it said no. And we talked through it, and it makes a really good point, right? Which is that record set is the API for 95% of users. Record set T is cabinet. And it's right. And like I said, like, after I built out the core of it, and I thought, well, I want to make this more developer friendly for myself. So I build out that. And yeah, as I said, like, that's how I'm going to use it. So, you know, it came back and it said, structure it into an extensions layer in the same assembly. Yeah, or, you know, you could put it in a separate assembly, but you should still distribute it as one NuGet package, because otherwise you know, there's cognitive load. Like, do I need both? Which one do I need? Which one does what?
I mean, it's not uncommon to have an extensions NuGet package available.
That's right.
Right.
And that was my thinking at first. But the point it makes here is quite good, which is that I'm not saying that the core is there and then the extensions are there for convenience who want it. What I'm saying is the extensions and the convenience should be the primary way of using it. And the core is there. The core exposes all the knobs and dials for people that want to tweak it.
So, like, just to play devil's advocate, though, is I can see that as being a very common discussion point for a lot of NuGet packages, right?
Mm.
Because, you know, you see it left, right, and center. There's the main package, and then there's the extensions package and whatever else.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, and I could only imagine that, you know, a lot of the repos and a lot of blog posts from the authors of those packages have had this internal debate and they've published it, right? So now the LLMs regurgitating those debates, summarizing and regurgitating those debates.
Mm.
So is it something that you could have found by good old-fashioned Google magic, right? Could you have come up with those same answers by spending a bit of time on Google? And was it just that the LLM surfaced that answer a lot quicker to you?
Possibly. The difference is that, you know, these are reasoning models, right? So it's not just regurgitating what it's found. Like I said, I've just summarized the conversation. It gave me pros and cons and arguments for and against all the different options, right? And yeah, like it's got some very decent arguments in the for here. So arguments for cabinet extensions, clarity of intent. Cabinet equals the core, I offline store, encryption indexing, cabinet.extensions equals quality of life, record set, record query, other extension methods. Flexibility, users who want low-level control can just install the cabinet package. Users who want the nice API can install the cabinet.extensions, which also then depends on the cabinet package. It's got clearer messaging, right? And, you know, it's like cabinet is the core encrypted storage engine, cabinet.extensions is the developer-friendly API layer. So, it's not just regurgitating stuff. It's providing arguments for and against and weighing them and giving me weighting. Now, ultimately, I felt that the arguments that it made for keeping them in one assembly, or at least in one packet, I'm still not sure about the assembly thing, right? I think two assemblies would make sense, but the whole thing is so small that it doesn't really. And again, that's part of it, right? But the two packages thing, I do agree. And part of my own experience is what drove that. So going back again to the MAUI plugin, right? The navigation, the page resolver one. I actually initially shipped that as I think 3 or 4 different packages, right? So I had one for the core, I had one for the attributes, one for the source generators. I can't remember. And like, it was a pain in the ass. And it was a pain in the ass for me, and it was a pain in the ass for people to use. So there is a lot to be said for just having all the things in one thing.
Yeah. And look, unless you need to, I don't see the point in creating extra libraries, extra DLLs.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think there's really much of a need for that. But you mentioned something earlier where you said if this was just something that you wrote on your own, you would just build it, bake it into the application.
Yeah.
But because you've, you know, had an AI agent helping you build it, you've built it as a separate product.
Yeah.
I've had the thought recently more along the lines of flipping that on its head.
Right.
Right. Whereby, you know, there's some boilerplate type open source packages out there. And, you know, the one that comes to mind at the moment is, say, Fluent Assertions.
Yeah.
Right. Not made, and we've had this discussion in the past, not overly complicated, not overly complex.
Yeah.
Right. Rather than paying their fees to use Fluent Assertions, I could actually just ask my AI tooling, Copilot, to build me a similar API.
You absolutely could,
Right?
Yeah.
Therefore, it's me as a developer or as a team here, I put minimal extra effort in to actually building up that tooling.
Yep.
And I've removed an external dependency.
Yep.
So like, I can see it happening that some of those lighter weight open source projects may start to lose as much traction when you can just say, implement this boilerplate feature in my product.
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is because over the past few weeks, well, months and years really, but over the past few weeks, I've seen it escalating. The number of open source projects that are starting to flood the social platforms has grown huge. It's because of the availability and the ubiquity of these AI tools, people were just starting to build things and share them. And, you know, a lot of them, this is something that we spoke about with Jimmy, a lot of them are definitely solutions in search of a problem. Like a lot of them are people that they want to put a package out there. So, you know, they're sharing something and they're building something and sharing it. And, you know, some of them are good, some of them are pointless, you know, whatever. Like it's all value, it's all experience, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But others you can see are definitely things that are born from experience and necessity, and you know, they're useful. But there's definitely an influx of, I guess, juniors or people wanting to gain experience and exposure and just clearly riffing off LLMs and saying, give me some ideas for, you know, an open source library, and then vibe coding them and shipping them. Like, you know, there's no shortage of that.
No, and I guess that's my point though, right? If it's so easy to do that for the open source library, why would I take a dependency on an external library when I can have that built quite easily within my application?
It depends on what the library is, right? So yeah, it depends. I mean, would you vibe code a OIDC or OAuth backend?
No. And that's what I said before, like the boilerplate, the low end, the low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Like the low hanging fruit. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I mean, this is the thing, is if it's, there's an element of muscle memory, there's an element of how quick it is. And maybe we spoke about this last week, but maybe they're inversely proportional, and maybe this will change. But right now, I think that there's a certain element of, okay, I'm standing up a new project. I need to add unit tests. I'm going to use XUnit or NUnit, right?
Yep.
I'm not going to say to my LLM, build me a testing platform.
No.
You know, I may move to TUnit eventually, because that looks really cool, actually. And maybe we should talk about that.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, I don't know, like lower hanging fruit, like yes, fluent assertions. I would still use Shouldly, because like why waste my time and my LLM cycles? And yeah, like, you know, also there's an environmental impact here as well. Like, you know, running all these GPU cycles.
There is. I think one of the reasons that comes to mind is to help prevent or minimize supply chain attacks that we've spoken about in the past.
Yeah, potentially.
Because you're no longer relying on external third parties. You've now got those dependencies inside your application. So you are now in charge.
Yeah.
Certain enterprises, what do we say? They may veto some packages, or they may have to approve certain packages before they can be used within organizations.
Yeah.
Yep. And, you know, as consultants and in this space where if I'm building a product for a client and their security teams or their whoever they've got to do the security side of it, look at it and say, no, you can't start. Like you need to now provide me a list of all the dependencies that you've got.
Yeah.
So then they can vet each dependency and tell you which ones you are and are not allowed to use. Like, we can minimize a lot of that.
It goes both ways. So some of it, yes, you can minimize, but on the other hand, sometimes, you know, they might, depending on what you're building, they might say, all right, what library are you using for encryption? Now, if they were asking me and I was using this, I could say I'm using the cryptography built into the .NET base class library. So that's easy enough to answer. But yeah, other things, like if you're, you know, anything security related, they might say, what are you using? And in that case, it might be desirable to have those packages vetted.
Oh, no, I do get that. I'm not saying it's a solution for everything, but I'm just saying that maybe moving forward, there is a world where some of that lower hanging fruit just gets duplicated across projects, rather than having one big central open source package that everyone just defaults to using because it's someone else has built that and it works.
Yeah. Well, we've already, you know, we've spoken about this before as well. There's a lot of, and it's a double-edged sword. It's a good thing and a bad thing. And I've literally just said this. There's definitely a big element of take away the cognitive load. I don't want to think about that. That's a solved problem. I want to solve a more important problem.
Yeah.
There's a package for that. I'm going to use it. Now, obviously, there's an upside and a downside to that. The downside is supply chain attacks. They can come from the most unexpected places. We were talking at the start of this call about a very significant vulnerability in .NET itself.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of made waves. We decided ASP.NET. ASP.NET, sorry, you're right. Yeah. Well, ASP.NET Core, if we're splitting hairs. But yeah, we decided not to go into that one. But, you know, supply chain attacks are everywhere. And again, this is also something, again, we spoke about with Jimmy, and we've mentioned before, is if you're bringing dependencies into your project, your solution, yeah, a fair amount of the responsibility is on you as well to make sure that you're doing the right thing and that you're being vigilant and you're monitoring those, not just vetting them initially, but monitoring them for changes and vulnerabilities and disclosures.
Absolutely. Look, don't know about you, Matt, but my eyes are starting to fall out of my head.
Yeah.
And I think I've just heard the call for the last drinks.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess that means there's no time for the thought experiments I had about where else you could use this. But
look, I'm just conscious that our editor is going to struggle to get this hour and a half conversation down.
Oh my God, yeah, fair
and
enough.
I don't want to overload him.
His capabilities are quite limited. And I say that jokingly because the editor of this episode is going to be you. And we literally spoke this morning about how I fucked up the episode that we released today.
I should apologize
to our audience, actually, like, as well. Yeah, I fucked up the edit, frustratingly, because I didn't, actually. I put together an absolutely beautiful edit, and then I messed up one thing and was trying to, like, undo to the point where, and like, the Audacity UI failed me, and I just couldn't, I lost track of what I was doing, and I apparently went back too far, and I had to rapidly re-edit a bunch of things that I'd already done, and I missed a whole bunch of other things. So, yes, I apologize humbly.
That's all right. I think, look, like I said to you too, the bits that, I don't want to go too far into it because it's just, can get overly into the weeds about how we came up with this. But as I said to you, you know, the bits towards the start that, look, I listened to it and I thought, you know what, I wouldn't have left that piece in there. I would have tidied that up a little bit. I think it's good to have it in there every now and then.
Yeah.
You know? And it's good just to show, like,
we're human, you know. We might sound like advanced supermen from a future time. We're just two blokes.
And I mean, look, at least one of us can make mistakes every now and then.
Which one?
And leave that for you to determine.
I think we've already established.
Okay, so I'm going to get kicked out of here shortly. So I think I'm excited. I think this is a great idea, and it puts together so many things that we have spoken about over the last 2 years, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, about over the last 2 weeks, really.
Well, not just 2 weeks, but the whole lot, right? We go back, you know, you've revisited what was your golden hammer, SQLite.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Right? Now, let's think about that otherwise. I think there's domain-driven design concepts in there that you're talking about too. Like, it just covers so much of what we have discussed. I think it's pretty cool.
Thanks. I mean, like I said, I'm happy with it. And the thing to bear in mind is that I didn't want to do this. I never set out to create this side project. I just needed it. And I
like
decided
I said,
to
it's
share
a side
it.
Quest.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed hearing about it. And thanks for letting me share.
Yeah. And I shall see you 2 days after this is released.
Yes. Exciting times.
Down in Melbourne for AdaConf.
That's right. In fact, when people hear this episode, we will be in Melbourne. In fact,
no, I get down there on the Thursday.
Okay.
I live in the world where, you know, everyone hangs out for the episode, drops on a Wednesday, and listen to it first thing as soon as it comes out.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, when people listen to this episode, I'll be in Melbourne. And when people listen to this episode, it will be 2 days to AdaConf.
That's it. Can't wait. Cool. You gonna wrap it?
Thanks again, Liam. And like you said, definitely last orders. So I got to get out of here. You got to get out of here. So thank you again for letting me share my excitement about my little side quest. But I do definitely think that is it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
And I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Yeah, and we can talk about AI, and I've got some what I think are quite interesting AI plans for it as well.
Yep.
So,
you know, scrape all the data from all your installs and train your own data model on it.
100%, exactly.
Yeah, take over the world.
Okay.
Or are you going to use it to run LLMs on everyone's mobile devices?
I thought you might ask that. Yeah, I can talk about that. I can talk about use cases.
No, I was just being a bit facetious. As in, do you hijack everyone's devices and have like this distributed LLM?
Use the compute. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for LLMs now. It used to be Bitcoin mining. Now it's LLMs.